The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society has been a major nonprofit in the world of blood cancers for almost 75 years. Stacy Kreisman is the Senior Manager of Patient and Community Outreach for this organization in New Jersey and Northeast Pennsylvania, and we'll talk about her role there on today's podcast. Stacy will also talk about the $175 million project that LLS has started called Dare to Dream. This initiative is concentrating on making as many improvements as possible for pediatric cancer patients who suffer from leukemia and lymphoma, which are the major blood cancers that strike these kids. Thank you for listening to this podcast. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society has been the largest nonprofit fundraiser of blood cancer research for nearly 75 years and has supported 85% of the blood cancer treatments approved by the FDA. Stacy Kreisman is the Senior Manager of Patient and Community Outreach for this nonprofit organization in New Jersey and in northeastern Pennsylvania. And it is now my pleasure to introduce her to my audience and welcome her to my podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, looking at your background, it seems to me as though you developed an early interest in a possible career in health and the health of children. Was the topic of cancer also an early interest of yours as well?
Not necessarily. I actually wasn't introduced to the topic of children's cancer until my first job out of grad school. I had a background and was pursuing a degree in a field called therapeutic recreation and took an internship placement at a Shriners Hospital in Tampa, Florida, that had a combined therapeutic recreation and child life department. And at the time, I had no idea what child life was. So this internship exposed me to this whole other side of working with children in hospitals and preparing them for procedures and surgeries and teaching them on an age-appropriate level what their experiences were going to be. And from that point on, decided to pursue that as a career and went to grad school for child life and family-centered care.
I'd like to just mention child life, the profession of being a child life specialist. I've had a number of the fortune of having a number of child life specialists on my podcast. I think they're about as underrated a profession as there is. That they're so close to hands-on working with these kids, and I just think that what they do is amazing. And I'm guessing you might agree with that.
I do agree with that and definitely agree that it is an underrated profession, not necessarily in the recent years, but back when I first started, it was, a lot of questions about, are you a volunteer? Do you get paid for what you do? Do you play with kids all day? And over the years, it has definitely become a more respected profession and widely utilized in so many different areas, not just within the hospital setting.
Now, you received your Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Florida and then moved 1,200 miles north, approximately, to Boston and received your Master of Science degree from Wheelock College, which is basically directly across the street from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Boston Children's Hospital. At the time you were there, did you ever imagine working as closely as you are in that field that Dana-Farber and Boston Children's Hospital are so immersed in?
I did not. I loved Boston while I was there. I had the fortunate experience to do some internships while I was there in local healthcare institutions and would have stayed. It was a field that was, with all of us graduating from a degree with child life and family-centered care, it was lots of competition for employment once we graduated. So needed to look elsewhere and ended up at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia after that, which, you know, is a rival city when it comes to children's hospitals, for sure.
No question. That was going to be my next question. As you spent 8 years at Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania, which is better known as CHOP, working in the child life and therapeutic recreation field, what was working in one of the leading pediatric cancer hospitals in the country like for you? And what lessons did you learn in that position that perhaps have stayed with you throughout the years?
Working at CHOP was nothing short of amazing. To be part of a 50-person plus department of child life specialists, child life assistants, school teachers, art therapists, music therapists, and the psychosocial staff that was available for all of the psychosocial needs for kids and their siblings and their parents and in supportive ways was unbelievable. Anything from, you know, obviously working in the playrooms, doing procedural support, preparation sessions, special events, all of the support that was necessary. It was just really an honor to be a part of that. It was a great time in my life. And knowing that there were so many groundbreaking medical advances and treatments that were going on at the time that has now obviously just grown and expanded a hundredfold between now and then, but was just an amazing experience.
Now, you then worked for 9 years at the Make-A-Wish Foundation in New Jersey. To me, that is one of the great foundations that's ever been invented. My guess, and you could tell me if I'm incorrect, is that it was hopefully a wonderful working environment, considering that you're granting wishes to these seriously ill children, many of whom do have pediatric cancer, and giving these little kids some happiness that they most definitely needed and need today and deserve. What was that experience like for you?
Working at Make-A-Wish was also one of the highlights of my careers. Being able to be a leader in that organization and oversee the wish granting, volunteer services, and medical outreach departments just gave me a really good sense of what it takes to make sure that children who had life-threatening medical conditions got the best experience that they possibly could from start to finish. So working with referral sources, what we refer to as referral sources, mostly child life specialists and social workers, directly from the children's hospitals throughout New Jersey, to educate them on what Make-A-Wish was, who is eligible for a wish, and how that process worked, directly through assigning volunteers to go and meet with those families who were eligible for a wish and talk with those children and ask them, if you had one wish, what would it be? And really exploring all aspects of that chosen wish with the child and the family, and then helping with our team to execute those wishes in whatever way that looked like for them, whether it was an I wish to go and I wish to have, I wish to be, and just making those happen. And in some circumstances, you know, we had what we called rush wishes, which were wishes that we needed to turn around very quickly because of the medical conditions and prognoses of the children that we were working with. But rewarding is not enough to really describe that experience.
I can just imagine the looks on these kids' faces when they find out that they're going to go to the place or have the wish that they want come to fruition. And that must be just so satisfying not just you, but everyone who was involved in this organization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt.
Now, you were also on the board of directors for a pediatric children's cancer camp called No Worries, which is a summer camp that invites kids who suffer from different forms of pediatric cancer, plus their siblings and bereaved siblings, to spend time not thinking or worrying about pediatric cancer. How important has this camp been to these kids who get at least somewhat of a break for what they're going through medically?
Absolutely. It is an invaluable experience. I think the children's cancer camp experience is invaluable for the entire family. It is respite for the parents, for sure. It is a break from everything associated with their cancer for both patients and siblings, who are often the forgotten population and spend their lives being bounced around from here to there, from family member to family member, or, you know, not having the attention on them as much as they need as well. And certainly bereaved siblings, those who have lost a brother or sister to cancer, are very often forgotten. And the fact that we're able to include all of those populations in 1 week for an overnight week every summer gives those children a really great sense that there are other children out there like them, regardless of what capacity they're in, whether they're patient, sibling, or bereaved sibling. And we don't focus on the cancer experience at camp at all, with the exception of one moment during camp where we do a memorial service to remember and honor those that we've lost from our camp family. But otherwise, there's no camp-related programming. What happens is very intrinsic and unplanned, and the conversations that the kids have before they go to bed, or while they're waiting for their canoes to go out, or sitting by the pool, are incredible, and is not something we could ever plan for, but is so natural to them.
I've had the honor of interviewing four or five different directors of these camps, and one of the things they always emphasize is the relationships that not just the campers, but also the parents can develop over time. And these relationships can continue for quite a while after the summer ends.
Yeah, absolutely. Relationships with fellow parents, relationships with camp staff. We really become a family. They become part of something that is greater than themselves, and really gives them a chance to understand that they are part of a community that they never wanted to be part of, but are somehow grateful for being part of that community and what it gives to them in so many different ways.
One of the things that I have not heard before talking to you when I did speak with these camp directors is the bereaved child, bereaved brother and sibling, aspect of it, to invite these kids to come. That is very, very interesting, and I hadn't thought of it before. Is that a major percentage of the kids that come, or is it mostly the kids that are suffering and their siblings?
It is mostly patients and their siblings, but we do have a percentage of kids who have lost a brother or a sister, and several of those kids who were kids when I first started with camp 20 something years ago are now part of our staff, have grown up at camp, recognize the value that they have gained over the years in helping them to process losing their sibling, and are now giving back to camp in leadership roles, which has obviously been a win-win for everybody, right? So It's not common in the children's cancer space for bereaved siblings to be included in those programs. Often there's separate programs for, you know, grief camps and bereavement camps and things like that. But this was important to our founders to include all of those populations that could really benefit from each other.
When did you decide to leave Make-A-Wish and join the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society? And why did you decide to make that change?
I left Make-A-Wish in October of 2016 and started at LLS in November of 2016. So I actually just celebrated my 7-year anniversary with LLS and was just looking for a change. I had been in the pediatric space for a very long time in my career and was just looking for a new challenge and to expand my role and take those skills that I had developed as a clinical child life specialist and then in the nonprofit world as well, and to combine all of that and take it somewhere where I could benefit even more people in a greater role. So here I am.
Well, you've certainly done that. I'd like to go over what you're doing now. You are the Senior Manager of Patient and Community Outreach at LLS, which is the short for Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, as I said before, in both New Jersey and Northeastern Pennsylvania. Can you talk about what this job entails? And if I'm reading your information correctly, you have to be knowledgeable in so many facets of the nonprofit, which include how to properly give information on the various blood cancers, educational information, emotional support, and financial assistance. Is it fair to say that you really are a jack of all trades?
It probably is fair to say that, yes. I often get asked if I'm a social worker. I am not a social worker by trade, although I operate in a similar capacity in identifying resources and services for blood cancer patients and their caregivers who are facing a diagnosis in any part of their journey, whether they're newly diagnosed, just starting treatment, headed into survivorship and beyond. And so you're right. Yes. There are many different aspects of this position as patient and community outreach manager, which my colleagues will definitely agree with. That is part resource giver, part, you know, emotional support, certainly when we talk to patients and families on the phone, or when we meet them at our education programs or in person at the treatment centers that we're visiting for outreach appointments. It is a little bit of everything.
Now, I'd like to discuss the fact that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is deepening its already deep commitment to the cause of pediatric blood cancer, as over the next 5 years, LLS is committing $175 million to a project which is called Dare to Dream. Can you talk about at least the overview of this project as we will get into some of the specifics? And how long has it been in the works for?
Yeah, absolutely. We're so proud of the Dare to Dream project. The Dare to Dream project started several years ago as the Children's Initiative, what was called the Children's Initiative at the time. And it was exactly that. It was our organization wanting to strengthen our commitment and our support and our research in the pediatric space. So commitment to increasing funding for pediatric research, commitment to increasing our advocacy efforts around issues that pediatric patients and their families are facing, whether it be lack of access to care or slow FDA approvals for new treatments. There have not been any new treatments that have been developed in the pediatric space for blood cancers in over 40 years. So those children who were diagnosed 40 years ago, who were being treated for leukemias, you know, ALLs, AMLs, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, acute myeloid leukemias, Hodgkin's lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's lymphomas mostly, are basically receiving a lot of the same treatments today than they were back then. So LLS started this children's initiative to recommit and increase our commitment to pediatric researchers, to pediatric patients, to pediatric families, to the community that is affected by pediatric cancer, in these various ways of research, advocacy, and patient support that mirror the pillars of our mission as a whole. And we've done just that. And so now we are called the Dare to Dream Project because we want to dare to dream. We want to dream about what could be if we are able to fund research to find less toxic treatments for kids that will have significantly less side effects, long-term late effects, that children who for years, even though their cancer has been cured, are experiencing life-altering and life-changing long-term side effects, whether it's cognitive, behavioral, physical side effects, from these very toxic treatments, and recommitting to supporting children and families in ways that we, even 7 years ago when I first started at LLS, that we did not have available, resources that specifically spoke to children and families who were undergoing and facing a pediatric cancer diagnosis. And now I feel like even in the 7 years that I've been here, we can be one of those front runners in supporting children with cancer, with the wonderful resources that we now have available, like our survivorship workbooks for children and adolescents, like our teens guide for everything cancer, and our coloring app, and our family calendars, and our caregivers workbook specifically for parents and guardians of kids who are going through cancer. So many resources that we have that are now specifically developed and geared towards this population.
Now, one of the stated goals of the project is to get every pediatric blood cancer patient affordable, accessible, and quality health insurance. I've got two questions to ask on that line. Do you have any type of figure of how many pediatric blood cancer patients there are currently in the United States? That would be my first question, roughly.
So there is an estimated over 54,000 children and adolescents younger than 20 years of age living with or in remission from a blood cancer currently.
So that's obviously a very significant figure. And the other question would be, can you give me any type of an estimate as far as of the 54 million people, how many of these kids have access to the type of healthcare that they need?
So just to clarify, 54,000. So it's difficult to put a number around their access. There are there's 200 what we call the 200 children's oncology group hospitals. So 200 children's hospitals throughout the country that are associated with the children's oncology group, as well as many community hospitals that have pediatric units and things of that nature that are equipped to handle their care in some capacity, right? That said, we know that there are children that have varying degrees of blood cancers, some of which are more high risk, are more involved, who need higher quality of care and or treatments that are not available closer to them, right? Geographically close to them. And so at LLS, what we are doing and what we did actually a couple of weeks ago in mid-October is we took 300 people to Washington, D.C. for our Dare to Dream Summit. And in that couple of days, these 300 individuals who were Leukemia and Lymphoma Society staff members, volunteers, pediatric cancer survivors, family members who had either lost a child to a blood cancer or had a survivor in their family and others, to talk to their local legislators and Senate representatives about the need for increased funding for pediatric research and data collection, as well as to streamline access to care for kids who need to go out of state for their treatment that is not available where they live. And it was an amazing experience to represent LLS in this way among the 300 others who were speaking on behalf of LLS as well, sharing their stories. And getting the word out to local legislators and Senate representatives about this need and how life-changing it can be, because it really is a life or death situation, right? If a child who lives in California needs treatment in Texas but cannot get that treatment in Texas because their physician is not part of that child's Medicaid program, then that's a barrier that we need to address. These children cannot wait months on end for that red tape and that paperwork to be in place. They just need the treatment in a timely manner so that they have the best possible hope for survival.
Were you happy with the reaction from the Senate and the congressional representatives that you spoke with? Were they interested, and were they pledging at least that they were going to take some of these suggestions and try to implement whatever they could?
Yeah, that will absolutely remain to be seen when those votes happen. But the goal, I think, was met, that, you know, we shared compelling stories of how exactly these bills will directly impact children and families like the ones that were standing in front of these representatives. And so the hope is, yes, that they will take those into consideration. And when it is time for those votes to come in for co-sponsoring or supporting the funding or these acts, that yes, they will remember the stories and that they will vote in our favor.
Now, I would like to bring up, you started to talk about some of the books and information that will be available during this with this project. You talked about survivorship and side effects management, which of course is critical. I would like to ask you about one of the books that you are working on, and it's on a patient's nutrition, which should automatically, I would think, be a very important part of any pediatric cancer patient's regimen, whether it's a child, someone a little bit older, or a teenager, an adolescent. But I'm not certain that proper nutrition is talked about as much as it should be. Is it fair to say that, or am I way off base?
It's a good question. It may be fair to say that, although I think that in recent years, it is becoming more prevalent to make sure that kids are getting the nutrition and building healthy habits in ways that will promote their success in treatment. I think there's so many studies out there, and any pediatric oncology dietitian can speak to the fact that what you eat directly affects how you feel. I mean, I think people without cancer know that to be true, right? And supporting kids who are getting treatment and have various side effects that need certain diet modifications to help with those side effects, that's where that nutrition comes into play in a bigger way for kids, especially who are, you know, obviously still growing and developing, and adding toxic treatments along to that growth and development, and how their nutrition can support that. And so, yes, our Nutrition for Parents booklet, and there's a children's supplement that goes along with that, helps parents to understand the correlation between their child's nutrition and their success in treatment and prognosis and beyond.
Your nonprofit is also funding its first global leukemia master clinical trial. Can you talk about that clinical trial and what is the hope that it will accomplish?
Absolutely. So the clinical trial is called the PEDAL trial. That's part of our Dare to Dream project. PEDAL stands for Pediatric Acute Leukemia. And it is a global precision medicine trial. And in saying that, for those who aren't familiar with precision medicine, is making sure that we are giving patients access to treatments that are individualized for their genetic makeup. So part of the PEDAL clinical trial is we are working with those 200 children's oncology group hospitals throughout the country to have each one of those hospitals open a screening trial that will screen high-risk ALL and relapsed refractory AML patients. So those patients who are not responding to treatment for their AML or high-risk ALL. It allows them to be genetically screened so that we can track certain markers. What does the DNA makeup of those children look like? Children who have pediatric relapsed refractory AML and ALLs, so that we can start to do some data on how to best conquer their disease. And not only that, to develop therapeutic agents that are significantly less toxic than the treatments that they've been getting for the past 40 some odd years, that will not have those same life-altering, life-changing, long-term side effects that some of the kids are experiencing now. So, so that's the basis, is really developing those agents that will be safer, less toxic, have less side effects, not just here in the United States, but globally. So there are several hospitals throughout the world who are also participating in this trial. And we're working with those hospitals to develop ways that we can collect the data so that is consistent globally, right? So if a child here in the United States has a fever at 100.1, just as an example, and a child in Germany is considered to have a fever at 102, this isn't consistent data, right? So we're now able with this trial to make sure that the data that we're collecting is reported in a consistent way so that we can then move forward and see, based on the genetic testing that comes back, how are we going to develop these agents that are specific to these children's genetic makeup, rather than just saying, here's what we've done for the past 40 years, this is what we're going to do now. It hasn't worked well, it isn't working well, and we need to do better.
Now, when we're talking about pediatric blood cancers, I'd like to first ask, divide this into two categories. The first one would be the pediatric leukemias, and the most curable, which is acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, followed by acute myeloid leukemia, or AML. That one is much more difficult, and as far as treatment, and also the harder to cure. Now, I realize you're not a scientist, but I would like to ask, if you know of the differences between the two, and are there any specific reasons why ALL is much more common, first of all, than AML, and why the cure rate is so much higher for ALL than it is for AML?
So in terms of cure rates, AML is a more complex diagnosis than ALL. The difference in the two diseases is that AML affects the myeloid cells. So these are the cells that give rise to certain types of white blood cells that are often the ones that fight off disease, right? ALL is a cancer that affects the lymphocytes, which are one of the primary blood cells in the immune response. But if we're directly affecting those white blood cells, it makes it harder for our bodies to fight off infections. And so that's the primary difference between the two of them. And yes, AML just historically has been harder to treat. There are, many ways in which we have obviously tried to do that over the years, and have been significantly more successful in the realm of ALL than we have in AML. Which is the reason for the PEDAL trial being the focus on AML and those relapse refractory kids who are not responding to treatment.
The other more prominent forms of pediatric blood cancer are the lymphomas, with both non-Hodgkin lymphoma and Hodgkin's lymphoma. What are the differences between non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and Hodgkin's lymphoma? And is one considered more curable than the other, although I've heard that the lymphomas do have a substantially high cure rate?
Yes. Yes to all of that. The difference between the lymphomas, obviously same. Lymphomas are types of cancer that begin in the white blood cells as well. And in the lymphocytes that are part of, the body's germ fighting immune system. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma arises in lymph nodes typically anywhere throughout the body. Again, I say typically, whereas Hodgkin's lymphoma typically begins in the upper body. So you may hear of patients who have tumors that they find in the neck, in their chest, in their armpits, things of that nature. Hodgkin's lymphoma tends to progress in a more predictable way than non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, making it a little bit easier to recognize and to treat than the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, of which there are hundreds of subtypes, which makes it harder to treat because it presents in so many different ways, if I can explain that.
Well, you explain it well, and I appreciate that, because I wasn't myself, and I probably should have been, really clear on the differences between those two. One of the events that is supported and sponsored by LLS is your Little Heroes Prom. Can you talk about this event and how popular it has become for the last several years?
Absolutely. So our Little Heroes Prom is an event that we are very proud of here in New Jersey. Our Little Heroes Prom is exactly that. It's a prom for pediatric cancer patients throughout New Jersey who come for a night where they can forget about everything associated with their cancer. We invite them and their immediate families, so siblings, parents. And a unique perspective of this event is that we also invite their medical professionals as well. And the reason that we do that is because we want to give their medical professionals a different view on, they see them in clinic, they see them in the hospitals, they see them when they're not feeling well, when they're down and out, and we want to give them an opportunity to see them in a much different environment. In addition to that, so we have a red carpet. The kids walk down the red carpet. Each one goes separately, so they have their moment in the spotlight. excuse me. And when they get down to the end of the red carpet, we present each one of these children with a medal that recognizes their journey, recognizes all that they've been through. And if a member of their medical team is present that evening, we allow that member of their medical team to present that medal to the child. So it allows both sides to really feel like they're recognizing all that they've been through. And then we party and we have a DJ and we have a glam station where they get to be all made up and decked out with glitter tattoos and, you know, makeup and all kinds of things. And they get to stuff their own stuffed animals and play in sports games and things like that. And it's just a night for them to pause, enjoy being with their family, enjoy dancing on the dance floor with members of their medical teams and their brothers and sisters, and celebrate what they've been through, celebrate their journey, celebrate how far they've come.
That sounds like just a great event and one that I'm sure gets more popular every year, and hopefully there's more participation every year. And my guess is that's probably true. Now, this podcast will be published a week from Monday, which is November 27th. 10 days after that will be Thursday, December 7th. And on that day, you are hosting a virtual event which focuses on the subject of coping with childhood cancer. Can you talk about this upcoming event and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So our program on December 7th is Coping with Childhood Cancer, The Power of Play and Creative Therapies, where, you know, there's so many different types of creative outlets that are proven to be effective methods of coping for children who are going through their diagnosis, for families who are affected by childhood cancer. And so we want to empower families. We want to empower both children and their families to build resilience during their treatment and beyond. We're inviting an oncologist, a pediatric hematologist oncologist, to join us to talk about the impact that those coping methods have on treatment, on kids' ability to be compliant with their treatment, how it makes them feel better. We'll share tools from an art therapist, as well as creative methods that child life specialists are using. And it's going to be a really great program. And it's virtual. It is free of charge for all families to participate in. And families can join us. And we'll put the link on your site that families can register to join us. It is Thursday, December 7th, 1 p.m. Eastern time. But families can join us anywhere in the country. And like I said, it'll be a program where families and children can learn about how to cope with this. This is actually part of a series of programs. So we'll have another one right over the new year in February, and another pediatric education program in about the May timeframe, for us to continue to support families who are going through childhood cancer in any way that we can.
As a final question, you told me early in the podcast that you had never really thought about cancer being a part of your career until you really went beyond your college years. Looking back, can you imagine now not being involved in the cancer community?
I can't. No, it's sort of a part of my life now. It's has given me so much more than perhaps I've given to the fields. I think that will remain to be seen, but just to know that you have a small part in helping children and their families and adults and their caregivers, you know, identify the support and resources that they need to make this journey a little bit better, has just been amazing for me. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, certainly you've made a big difference. You said it remains to be seen. It doesn't remain to be seen. It's been seen, and it'll be seen more and more as time goes on. How can people get in touch with you? And how can people get in touch with if they want to join the event on December 7th?
Absolutely. So people can get in touch with me or LLS, I should say. My email is stacy.kreisman@lls.org is my email. I'm only one of 27 patient and community outreach managers throughout the country at LLS. There is a patient and community outreach manager in all 27 of our regions throughout the country. So if you are listening from somewhere other than New Jersey or Northeastern PA, you can still feel free to reach out to me and I will put you in touch with your local patient and community outreach manager. LLS.org is our website, one-stop shopping, and is a wealth of information on everything you need to know about the blood cancers and the research that we are working on, the advocacy efforts that our Office of Public Policy is diligent about, and the support that we are offering to patients and families to improve their quality of life. And if people want to join us on our education program on Thursday, December 7th, they can register via our online registration form. And the website there is na.eventscloud.com/PEDSNE. So that PEDS Northeast is what that stands for. Again, it's na.eventscloud.com/PEDS Northeast, PEDS NE.
To come to the end of this podcast, I want to, first of all, thank you very much for that information. And thank you very much for taking the time to join me, coming out of a sick bed, by the way, to be able to talk so beautifully about the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, what you've done before, what you're doing now, and this fight that you have gone into with full power to try to help these kids and others in this, as I've said, the worst possible scenario is pediatric cancer. And you're certainly a believer in that. And what you're doing is great now. And again, is going to be around for a long time. And I want to wish you the best of luck as time goes on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me this platform to talk about the wonderful work that we are doing at LLS and our upcoming program, and hope that people will join in.
Well, I do too. And you have a good day.
Thanks. You too.
I hope that you appreciated hearing Stacy discuss all that she is involved with in the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and how this nonprofit has made an even deeper commitment to the cause of pediatric blood cancers. This is Mark Levine, and please tune in on Thursday when I will speak with Grainne Owen, who will talk about the loss of her then 9-year-old son, Killian, who passed away from acute lymphoblastic leukemia in July of 2003, and her amazing efforts on many fronts to help find a cure for pediatric cancers.